If you brought a Bible, if you would turn with me to John's Gospel, not 1 John, but John's Gospel, one of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John in the New Testament. And we're in chapter 2, John chapter 2. Now, throughout the Gospels, we've gotten pretty, as a culture and as a people of God, we've gotten pretty acquainted with Jesus and who he is. But the initial community that was getting to know this word become flesh, God come from heaven and taking on human form, it was quite a startling idea. The whole concept was outside the box of what anybody had to get their minds around at that point in time. And each time that Jesus reveals something of himself, it surprises people. We saw at the very beginning, that John the Baptist baptizes Jesus and the Spirit of God comes on him like a dove and remains on him, and a voice from heaven comes in that. What in the world is that? Then you have Jesus turning water, one substance into another substance, wine at a wedding in Cana. You have all kinds of different things. Jesus stills the storm. What do they say? They say, who is this that even the wind and the waves obey him? He comes out walking to his disciples in a boat. Who in the world is this? What manner of man is what the old translations say. What manner of man is this? What he walks on the water. He rises from death. And today, the passage that we're looking at is Jesus coming into the religious establishment of the day, the temple in Jerusalem, the temple of God in Jerusalem, which has become at this point in time known as Herod's temple, although it had been being built for a long time. Herod has done this giant renovation project over 46 years up until this point in time. And so you've got Jesus coming into Jerusalem at the Passover season, and he essentially gets into attack mode. And this is a serious challenge to our gentle Jesus sort of idea that we think that Jesus is sort of this genteel, never kind of threatening, only saying good things, never really challenging us with our stuff. Instead, he's turning over the tables of normalized religion at that point in time. The passage is going to reveal to us something like this, that jealous Jesus replaces that genteel Jesus. And he comes into our world and turns things upside down to set things right inside of us and in our world. And he's still doing that. He's still setting things right by turning some things upside down. Now, I want to walk you through this passage today. And as we do, basically, I believe that the Lord's going to turn some things upside down with you. And he only challenges those things that need fixing, or as they say in the South, fixing. He challenges that which needs fixing. And so if the Lord starts challenging things today, just know that Jesus is the one who's doing it. He's come in, and that's part of following him, is that he will challenge the status quo. He will say things to you that might rock the boat, might turn things upside down. He might say to those of you that are dads in a family where you're kind of the Lord, he might say, you need to become the servant of your family. And that would turn things upside down, wouldn't it? To wives, the Lord might say to you today, part of turning it upside down is he wants you to stop competing with your husband and maybe start learning how to work this thing called biblical submission out. But husbands, you as well, because nobody gets out of submission in a kingdom where there's a king and you're not him. That makes sense? See, the Lord turns things upside down, and that's what he does in this passage today. I want to walk you through this several verses at a time. In verse 13 is where we're picking up in the story this morning, and it says, when it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. So the Passover is one of three pilgrimage feasts that the Jewish people had, where everyone in the region would make these periodic pilgrimages to Jerusalem. And this Passover feast was the prince of all of those feasts, if you will. It was the time when the people of Israel celebrated the deliverance from slavery in Egypt. They came to Jerusalem and they came to the temple. And the temple was not just another church with a steeple on the corner. Very important. And I think it's difficult for us in America to get this idea of the people and the place being so intrinsically marked. I was at the nation's capital 2 weeks ago in the rotunda of our capital. And I knew that I was in the seat of power, but it only had marginal meaning to me. Whereas for a Jewish person in Jerusalem, it meant everything. Temple was their identity. It was the centerpiece of everything for them. Theologian N.T. Wright puts it this way, that it was a It was the center of worship and music, of politics and society, of national celebration and national mourning. But towering above all these, it was, of course, the place where Israel's God, Yahweh, had promised to live in the midst of his people. It was the focal point of the nation, and it was the national way of life. So when we have temple, we're not just talking about church. We're talking about a holy place of the Jews and then a court of the Gentiles. And it is a very large area. It's not a small area. So out in this court of the Gentiles is a marketplace. And so it says in verse 14, in the temple courts, he found people selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. So the people that have made their pilgrimages to Jerusalem have come there primarily to sacrifice to the Lord their God. Their sacrifice would be an act of worship, and their sacrifice would be an act of atonement for their sins, that this animal would replace, would take the place of them, would pay the price for their sins. And so the temple would be that place where they came for that. Now, also, because a person in Israel proper, the land of Israel, if you will, that made this pilgrimage to Israel, or made the pilgrimage to Jerusalem, likely would not have the time nor the ability to lug an animal with them all the way to Jerusalem. So once they got to Jerusalem, there would be people that would sell them the sacrifices that they weren't able to bring with them. On top of that, because the currency was uneven throughout the region, there would need to be people that were exchanging currency for the currency of Jerusalem, and there were all people on the take, if you will, with that. That's what Jesus is taking on there. But what we've got basically in the temple courts is a full-on Middle Eastern bazaar. You know, a place where there's all kinds of stuff. There's cattle and all kinds of sheep bleeding and cattle mooing and all these things inside the place where God is supposed to be worshipped. I mean, picture that for just a second. This is not a particularly holy place for us. But if we just had a bunch of cattle and sheep and cha-ching and things like that going on while we're trying to worship, would that be a little distracting? Some of you would be like, can you get the animals out of here? It stinks, for one. You know, you got a bunch of animals in one place, and you've got a lot of odor, if you will, fragrance. And this is happening inside the temple courts. And so picture this. This is what Jesus does. So he made a whip out of cords. And he drove all from the temple courts, the sheep and the cattle. So you got everything. These animals are going all over the place. Now it's pandemonium. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And to those who sold doves, he said, get these out of here. Stop turning my father's house into a marketplace. And his disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for your house will consume me. So this is not your gentle Jesus, is it? No, this is not some sort of genteel, you know, sort of British, oh, very proper, you know, type of a thing. This isn't. This is a jealous Jesus instead, and he's angered at the unholy use of this very holy place. Let me say that again. He's angered at this unholy use of a very holy place. Now, he's offended when people take what is sacred, what is holy, and what is honorable, and treat it in a trite and nonchalant and, well, anything kind of goes, it doesn't really matter sort of a way. These things offend the Lord our God. These offend Jesus, the Word become flesh on the earth, and basically he is taking on this, hey, we can take make some good money scalping religious goods, basically, is what's happening. These guys are scalping people on the way in. But what's offensive is not that these people need their currency exchanged. What's offensive is not that there are animals that are available for people to buy in order to sacrifice to their Lord, but these things have been brought in and made this sacred place into something completely unsacred. And so Jesus is offended by this. And you see this with some degree of regularity within the whole Bible. You see in 2 Samuel 6, there's the story of King David bringing the Ark of the Covenant back into Jerusalem after the Philistines had actually captured it. And David, he's well-intentioned. He says, I want to bring the Ark of God back into Jerusalem, put it in the tabernacle. And so he goes to the place where it's the Philistines had taken it. The Philistines, it didn't go so well with the Ark. And so they gave it to another Israelite guy. And David goes to this guy, Obed-Edom, and gets to take the Ark of God back to Jerusalem. He puts it on a cart. Makes sense, right? Here's oxen, and here's the Ark of God, this very sacred thing that encases the Ten Commandments, the tablets of the Ten Commandments are inside of it. And the oxen began to move back toward Jerusalem. Well, at one point in time, it says, in the flattest place of the land, that the oxen stumble and the cart kind of tilts over to one side, and one of David's men is close in. Guys puts his hand up to steady the Ark, and bam, the Lord strikes the guy dead. And David's response is, what? It says that David was afraid and David was angry. Why can't the Ark come to me? He throws kind of a little mini tantrum there. And he says, God, I'm trying to do this great thing for you. But he hadn't done his homework. Because the Lord had already specified that only the Levites can handle the Ark in only a certain kind of a way, because this is a very sacred and holy thing. Does that make sense? And so the Lord is, I think that this is important for us, because we need to do our homework and say that actually God does consider some things holy. I remember talking to a young man years ago who at one point in time in his high school career said, I'm not going to date any women for the rest. I made a covenant with God not to date any women for the rest of my high school career. And then a year later, he started to date a girl. And he's like, hey, what do you think of that? What do you think of her? And I'm like, what about this covenant thing? Oh, well, I know I said that, but I don't know if I really meant that. I'm like, these are things that you don't mess with these things with your God. This is the Lord of the universe that we're talking about. This is not some sort of imaginary friend that we're making up in our own brains. Does that make sense? And so I think it's important for us to note that we need to do our homework to know that God is jealous for the things that are holy. And actually, the scripture says that you are one of those things that are holy for him. Not holier than thou, but holy, set apart for him. Now, the question I think that begs to be asked in this is, what was so wrong with the temple that would prompt Jesus to do what he did? Now, I think it's important to say that we need to remember what the purposes of the temple were. And I'm just going to give you fivefold, but I'm just getting going with this. Firstly, the temple is the place where people are, they connect with God. Secondly, the temple is the place where atonement is made for sins and forgiveness is released. Thirdly, the temple is a place where God's presence and his glory dwells and is revealed. Fourthly, that the temple is the place where people worship God, and it is also the place where God's heavenly kingdom touches down on earth. The ark was a throne. That's what it was. Is that the heavenly king has made his throne here. And so it is a manifestation of heaven's kingdom right down here on earth. So what's wrong with this? Well, for one, they've made the temple this place, this is not what the temple is for. The temple was never intended to be a business. What's wrong? Well, the place where God dwells is holy to him, and they have lost the sense of the holy, of the sacred. And so Jesus is offended. What's wrong with this? Well, whenever worship becomes commercialized, we may be unknowingly offending the one that we are trying to worship. Whenever it becomes a business, whenever the act of worship becomes the business of worship, now we've crossed a line. We've crossed a line. Over the years, I've attended a lot of weddings, and I've had a chance to officiate a lot of weddings, and I quite like doing that. But I've been to weddings, and a wedding is supposed to be about the covenant that two people are making together. That's what a wedding is about, just to be clear. But sometimes the covenant that these two people are making is vastly eclipsed by the singer's performance, or the fashion on display, or the officiant or the pastor making it a comedy routine and a look at me. All of those things are taking something that is a holy moment, like we sang at the beginning of the service, and making it something trite, making it something devalued. And I believe that the Lord is particularly offended by that. Now, when I say holy, I don't mean somber. Somber and holy are two very different things. I was at probably perhaps the most holy moment of my life at my son's wedding. And I had a chance to stand up in front of he and his bride, and there was hilarious laughter and unbelievable emotion and tears. There was joy. We worshiped. We sang. We laughed. I had to keep her from kissing him before it was time. And it was all part of the holiness of the moment. So holiness and joy actually with God go together. So let's say that holiness is somber and somehow stayed and uptight. That's not it at all. Holiness simply means that it's set apart for God. And because it is, it has a different kind of a value than anything else. And I want to say in a gentle but straightforward way that I believe that in our American culture that we've lost the sense of the holy, that we've lost the sense of the sacred. And it has made faith sort of a trite thing, just add Jesus. It's made discipleship an option. It's made worship a concert. And I think that in many ways, as a church in America, I don't mean us in particular, but I mean us in general nationally, that we have lost the sense of the holy. And I believe that we need to recover that because God is the one who's jealous for that. I want to let that sit on you for a moment. It's sitting on me in a fairly serious way. Now, this doesn't make everybody particularly happy. Obviously, you go into this very populated place with a bunch of religious people and a bunch of marketplace people, and you've offended pretty much everybody. And Jesus was not, you know, as you saw from the slide intro, we're talking about a real whip. I mean, that's not like Jesus didn't go, oh, sorry, oh, did I mess that up? Oh, no, there was none of that. He's throwing things around, and he's got a whip, and he's whipping animals out of there. You know, you got to actually do something to get cattle out of that place. And there is some violence in this, and so the Jewish leaders are, well, they're ticked. And so they respond to him, what sign will you show us that to prove your authority to do this? Because they want to know, hey, this is wrong, and you don't have anything to back this up. And so they're challenging him with this, and Jesus gives this very encrypted reply. He says, destroy this temple, and I will raise it up in 3 days. Well, they replied, it has taken over 40 years to build this temple, and you are going to raise it up in 3 days? And this is really where John wants us to turn with this. But the temple he had spoken of was his body, was his very own body. After he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said. Because remember, the disciples now, they're like, what? 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 They don't get it. It takes them a long time to get it on this. And it says that then after they got it, in recalling this, that they believed the scripture and the words that Jesus had spoken. What did Jesus answer to this very encrypted answer mean? Well, firstly, and I think foremost in this that he would want us to get, that John wants us to get by this, is that Jesus is replacing in himself, he's replacing the temple. He's replacing the temple as the place where people connect with God. He's replacing the temple as the place where sin is atoned for and forgiveness is released. He's replacing the temple in the place where is the place where God's presence dwells and his glory is revealed. He's replacing the temple as the place of true worship. He's replacing the temple as the place where God's heavenly kingdom touches down on earth. He is the real temple. That's what he's saying. And that's what's so offensive to them. Now what he's saying because of this is that we don't have to make a pilgrimage to Israel or to some shrine somewhere in the world or Bethel or anywhere else to be able to connect with God, that you can raise your hands and raise your voice and lift up your heart right now and you can connect because the holy is now inside of you. That's a rather radical change from all the rest of the religions on the planet. What happens with Muslims? They bow down and they face toward Mecca. We don't face toward Jerusalem because the God of Jerusalem, the God of Israel, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the God of you is here now. He took on flesh and he's here now. And that's just miraculous. And secondly, the second part of this that's so important is that Jesus previews how this is going to come to be in his death and resurrection. That's how this is going to come all to be. Is that all of these five things that I've said to you, the connecting with God, the sin atonement, the presence and the glory, the true worship, the heaven come, all of that is going to be inaugurated in his death and his resurrection. So he points to that. That there would be a final lamb that is sacrificed. We've already talked about that. And sin would be covered. And now worship is taken into the human heart, which is now also a temple. Incredible. Staggering. Mind-blowing. And this is the work that Jesus came to do. He came to replace the temple. Remember last week I said that Jesus over and over again is taking on the symbolism of all of these Jewish feasts and all of these Jewish high rituals, and he's saying, I am the fulfillment of all of these things. I am myself it. Now, the disciples, just as a sidelight here, the disciples didn't get it when he first said it. Now, I don't know about you. Actually, I do know about you that Jesus says all kinds of things to you that you don't get on the first try, right? Right? Because we're a little McFly, you know, hello, Marty McFly on that. That we don't understand something, but later we do get it in retrospect. But I want to say to you that I want to sort of take a piece of their playbook and say they looked back and saw something that Jesus said and did, and that fortified their faith. It caused them to jump in, to re-anchor, to refresh their faith in him. And I want to encourage you to look back today for a moment on the things that God has done for you, not just at the cross, but even in your life with him. And I want to ask you to go back, even perhaps parents and around the dinner table today, to look back and say, what did God do in the last year? And let's talk about that, and let's let that feed our faith. And what did God do 2 and 4 and 6 and 10 years ago that we need to recall those things and re-anchor our faith into those things, because it's not until afterward that we can look back and see, oh, God was working. And we need that. You know that we need that. And so I want to encourage you, this is part of the reason why the Jewish have feasts. Is because they have regular occurrences of times to remember. And Jesus didn't come to replace our need to remember. Do you understand? It's really important that we need to take that time, that reflection time, and then let that fortify our faith. And that brings us back into this very last portion of our passage for today. In verse 23, it says, now, while he was in Jerusalem at the Passover festival, many people saw the signs that he was performing and believed in his name. And these words are a play on words that I want to take apart with you for a moment. But it says that, but Jesus would not entrust himself to them, for he knew all people. He did not need any testimony about mankind, for he knew what was in each person. He knew what was in each person. Now, once again, like the water and the wine miracle, people responded by believing. They responded by believing in him. That's the way that you join him. You believe. That's the way that you join in. But this passage actually exposes what John and what Jesus are talking about when they say believe. Because listen to this and look at the passage itself. If you go back to the actual reading and the whole thing. So it says, yeah, this one right here. So it says they believed in him and the one before this. And then it says that he performed signs and they believed in his name. Now the next slide. Now it says, but Jesus would not entrust himself to them. Same word. It's the same Greek word, believe and entrust yourself to them. That they believed in Jesus. They entrusted themselves to him, but he would not entrust himself to them because he knew it was in them. John is pulling back the veil, so to speak, of what this believing that he's talking about throughout his entire gospel, what it means. Believing means to entrust yourself to someone. That's what the believing means. It's the same word that he uses in both. It's the same Greek word. So it's not, I'm not, you know, trying to deceive you. It's interesting that our scholars have chosen to translate one word believe and the other one to entrust, but it's the same word. It's the same concept. To believe is to entrust. Now, this was about 33 years ago, I think. 33 years? 33 years ago, Becky entrusted herself to me, and I entrusted myself to her. That we stood in front of a bunch of people and her dad, who is the officiating pastor, a bunch of witnesses, and we pledged ourselves to each other. And she gave up something of who she was and what her life was apart from me, and I gave up mine as well to create this union. It was this entrusting ourselves to each other that was the key to having the union. You don't entrust, you don't have the union. You don't make that step, you don't get the benefits that go with that step. This is putting your trust in Jesus. Have you entrusted yourself to Jesus? That's my big question. That's Jesus' question to us. Have we entrusted ourselves to him? Take that a little bit deeper. Or what part of us are we in a tug of war with him on that we have not entrusted ourselves with? Because you may have taken the step of faith to initially believe in him, which you need to. There's always a beginning. But that isn't the ending. That the beginning of entrusting yourself is the beginning step of a whole bunch of other entrusting yourselves. And that the rest of your walk with Christ is going to be continuing to re-entrust stuff that you took back, or the tug of war that you're saying, no, God, I can do this better than you. No, really, I can do this better. I got this one, right? All of us do this. Now, this is not unique to me, although I'm quite good at this. But the idea here is that you've got something, a relationship or a sin or a career or a decision or some kind of thing that you need to do, but you are in this tug of war with God. And what's at stake is your trust. Do you trust me? The Lord says. Will you entrust yourself to me? Is she the one? Should I take this next step? Should we move there? Oh, God, no, no. If you lead a small group, the small group belongs to Jesus, because all his people belong to Jesus. But no, but they're mine. No, they belong to him. And this journey that we're on together has largely to do with us re-entrusting and saying, I lay this down before you, God. I trust that you have my best in mind. I know you can work this out. But the more that we have our own paws on something, the more we just get what comes with having our own paws and having our own control. But you know as well as, well, maybe you don't know as well as I do, but I know that there's a large difference between the effects of God having his fingerprints all over something and just mine being on it. And mine really are pretty pathetic. And what I can produce of my own will and my own strength is pretty pathetic. But what my God can do through me and through you and with me and with you is nothing short of miraculous. And so he comes this morning and says, will you entrust yourself to me? All of it. No holding the one thing or the two things or the 50 things back. All of it. All of it. This is what it means to believe. To entrust yourself to the God who is ultimately trustable and trustworthy. So let me recap. Firstly, I believe that the passage says that we need to upgrade to a more complete and true view of Jesus, that he is both gentle and jealous, that he is true and compassionate, that he's merciful, but he will confront us. He's truth. That we need to upgrade to a more true view of Jesus. Secondly, that we need to take holy things, we need to take the holy things and No, we don't. We can't. We can take holy things and make them mundane, and we need to stop doing that. That we need to recapture a sense of the holy. Thirdly, and I think most importantly with this passage, that Jesus himself is the complete means and the place to connect with God, to find forgiveness, to experience God's presence and glory, to respond in true worship. It's him. He is the place where God's heavenly kingdom has come to earth, and now he lives in the midst of us, and he lives in your heart if you have opened your heart to him. That, my friends, that's a miracle. It's incredible. Fourthly, that he is calling us to entrust ourselves to him and to follow him. And lastly, he knows everything about you. That's scary, isn't it? He knows everything about you and still came to save you. Everything. And so his question to you this morning is, will you entrust yourself to me? Oddly enough, you think, but I'm going to lose who I am if I do this. And what's interesting is you entrust yourself and you surrender to God, you become more of yourself, not less. The world wants to say, no, you give up something and it's all loss. And actually the kingdom says, the king of the kingdom says, no, you give up something and you actually become more, not less. It's the kingdom of God. And because the king is here right now, the kingdom is as well. And so I want to ask you, will you entrust yourself or re-entrust yourself? Or entrust that thing that you're holding back, will you trust God with that today? Will you? Let's stand up.